Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Andrew McGregor. Andrew, we seem to be having a little bit of a problem with your camera. That button for your camera there that I got you to click before, if you click it again, it'll just turn it off. There was a little bit of a difficulty getting your voice. That's good. That's good right there. Okay, cool. All right, Andrew, welcome to the program. We're going to be talking about the Port Arthur massacre. It's like the ultimate shooting debacle in Australian history, which, much like almost every shooting debacle that happens in every other country, New Zealand's had them, America's had them, they just get used to demonise all gun owners and were probably, most likely, false flag attacks in and of themselves to begin with that were orchestrated in order to get people's guns. So welcome to the program, and I really want to learn a bit more about this because I'm not terribly well informed, I must say.
It would be nice if you had been a little bit informed. You could have asked some rather relevant questions, or questions that would have been relevant to you. Port Arthur massacre. For a start, Vinny, can you tell me which is the world capital for low nut mass killings?
It's a good question. I don't know.
How about Melbourne in Victoria,
really?
Australia? We've had four of them.
How interesting. How come it's not hyped up on the news and repeated over and over and over again?
I don't think the anti-gunners or the government will be greatly amused with that type of, thing going on in Australia. But that is the actual fact that we had the first low-nut gun massacre shooting on the 9th of August 1987 with Julian Knight at the Hoddle Street, which is Clifton Hill, the suburb of Melbourne. And Julian Knight survived. He was caught by two members of the Fitzroy Uniform Police, and he stated that he didn't know what he was doing. He thought he was shooting Martians, which simply means it is under a major psychosis. The next shooting took place in about December 1987 in the Queen Street Massacre, which is the Queen Street, the philatelic post office. Now, that particular building was a federal building with federal security in it. And the gunman, who apparently had never been there before, managed to get past the security. And he was going around ranting. And one of the rants he made that people heard and remembered was, "How do they expect me to kill people with this gun?" Which was an M1 carbine, and that fitted into the bag he used to carry it to the this area. Somebody had cut off part of the butt and then the part of the barrel, which immediately stopped the M1 from being a semi-automatic, and it could only be hand-loaded, or, you know, with the action, and this particular firearm jammed more times than it actually fired. So that was the second one. Then we had the Abortion Street killings in East Melbourne in 2001, and then finally in 2003 we had the Monash University shooting. In both those last two instances, some of the supposed sacrificial lambs actually jumped up and grabbed the gunman and stopped it. The real interesting thing with the Monash University shooting was when Associate Professor Brett Inder entered the room, the gunman said to him, "It was all I could do."
Now, Andrew, before you continue, by the way that you're recounting these instances and the details that you're recounting and the way that you do, it would lead me to suspect that you have actually had a career where such a skill is necessary. Were you a police officer or something?
I was a member of the Victoria Police Force from 68 till 85. I retired in health in 1985 after running into some problems with a thing called corruption.
That'll do it.
Every time.
Every time. So can I ask you just about yourself personally before we actually continue on to talk about mass shootings and the Port Arthur massacre, some of your experiences and kind of who you are as a person so the audience can become familiar as well as myself?
Well, I joined the Victoria Police Force in 1968, the year after my eldest sister was murdered by a former boyfriend on the front yard of my parents' house in West Heidelberg. And, that had upset me greatly. He was later found in a creek area a couple of miles away from home. He'd committed suicide. But that took place on her 24th birthday, and I was extremely upset that it had happened and that previous actions by the police had failed to take the gun off at this deranged person, and he was able to kill my sister. So I'm not a person particularly fond of firearms, but I'm not a person against firearms. Firearms are a tool, an implement. They never jump up and shoot people. It's somebody's got to pull the trigger. And so when the Port Arthur massacre finally came around, and I can remember listening to the radio in the car when it was first announced, about a gunman going mad, and I turned the radio off in disgust because I knew it was going to be psyched up. Later on, I came around to study it. I got a copy of the court transcript where Martin Bryant was sentenced. Martin Bryant was never put on trial, and he should have been. The day of his arrest, one of the members of the Coalition for Gun Control stated quite emphatically that Martin Bryant had a mental condition, which simply meant that he was suffering from schizophrenia. And if he was suffering from schizophrenia, there had to be a trial. So another anti-gunner came along, Professor Paul Mullen, who said, no, he didn't. He only had a personality disorder. He's quite perfectly, competent to be tried. But there was never a trial. Martin Bryant, on the 30th September, when he was facing his first hearing, pleaded not guilty to all charges. And his solicitor, Lieutenant Colonel David Gunson, the head of the legal bar in Hobart, immediately stood aside, and the solicitor, John Avery, took over. Now, John Avery also represented Carlene Bryant, Martin Bryant's mother, and the gun dealer, Terry Hill. Now, it's extremely interesting with the gun dealer because shortly before Avery took over for Bryant, Avery had written to Terry Hill asking him to give evidence that he had sold the murder weapons to Martin Bryant, which was a lie. And Terry Hill declined to tell this particular lie, and so the police ended up raiding his shop and closed his business down, collected all his books. These are just little aspects of what's happened. You start reading the sentencing document, and you're absolutely amazed. You then start reading the witness statements, and they are absolutely astounding. The first thing you find out is that according to the police documents, when David and Sally Martin were killed at between 10:30 and 12 o'clock, that Martin Bryant was 58 kilometres away drinking coffee, as per the witness statement. You've got witnesses stating that Martin Bryant arrived at the Seascape Cottage, which was the first and the final scenes, at 12:30. The shootings were heard by other witnesses from Seascape Cottage from 10:40 a.m. And that's from four different witnesses. So you've got major problems with the police evidence, and you can understand why the whole Tasmanian government, the Australian federal government, all required Martin Bryant to plead guilty, which John Avery was finally able to coerce Martin Bryant to do so simply by getting Martin Bryant's mother to go in and tell Martin if he didn't plead guilty, then neither she nor Martin's sister would ever be able to visit him at Risdon Prison. That's really not a legalist assisting a client.
It sounds like somebody didn't want him to talk. Or have contact with anybody that might try and, I don't know, spread out
things. Nobody's permitted to speak to Martin Bryant. That was made perfectly clear in an article by Gary Linnell in the Bulletin in about 1998.
Oh, come on. Even Charles Manson was allowed to have people talk to him, and he was a knowing mass murderer.
No, well, Martin Bryant, his mother got one visit to him, and she asked him if he'd actually did these things at Port Arthur, and he said it must have been a police setup. And after that, he became too agitated, and she was frightened to ask him anything further.
Define police setup. What evidence do we have that there was police present? Was there any reports of multiple shooters, things of that nature?
There were reports of multiple shooters. I've named the main shooter at Seascape Cottage to be Sergeant Michael Charles Dyson of the Tasmania Police Special Operations Group. The shooter at the Port Arthur Historic Site as being Benjamin Overbeek. And I stated that quite emphatically, and nobody sued me as yet.
And what are those gentlemen's background? Do they have military training or just police training?
The shooter at the Port Arthur Historic Site was a 20-year-old. I don't know what actual training he had. There's no record of him being in the Australian Army. But the person inside who did the shooting at the Port Arthur had been very properly trained. People saw him moving around and pirouetting when he was shooting inside the cafe. He certainly knew how to handle firearms. But the real interesting thing about the Port Arthur massacre is the number of ASIO, that's the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation, they lost 7 people that day. Our equivalent to the CIA lost 7 operatives at the Port Arthur massacre. And there are over 30 of them that that can be identified.
How could we account for that? I mean, were they armed, capable of defending themselves? Were they?
They were all there as witnesses. There were 4 American spooks there. William and Marianne Bittner and James Belasco and his fiancée Cynthia, and Cynthia's got a horrible Polish name that I can't pronounce.
So maybe it was in some part an international training operation of how to stage shootings, perhaps?
The gunman told 2 witnesses. That's Gay Lind and her friend Vicky, who were in a van broke the radiator, or the motor had overheated and they had to put more water in the radiator. And they're waiting for the motor to cool down. The gunman stopped behind them to find out what they were doing there. He bought some marijuana from them. And he then told them that he was going to the Isle of the Dead, which was the Port Arthur Historic Site Cemetery, to kill some wasps. We have another spook, Rob Atkins, who was quoted on the all news media, both Channel 2 and Channel 9, that the gunman was saying, going around saying that there are not many Japs here, there's a lot of wasps. And in fact, there were. There are 2 busloads of, what you'd call coachloads of American tourists on the site that day who arrived unexpectedly. And the ferry that would take them to the Isle of the Dead and do a run around the Isle of the Dead and the other area around that, the Bundina. and had a fortnight previously changed from a summer timetable to a winter timetable. And all the doctor's seminar at the Royal Hobart Hospital on that was related to this, that seminar closed at 1:30. The shooting at the Port Arthur Historic Site had to take place at 1:30, but it was supposed to take place on the ferry. It didn't, because the timetable had changed. So the gunman then took out the patrons in the Broad Arrow Cafe, which was supposed to be a secure site. And the first Australian spook to get shot was Anthony Nightingale, who jumped up and shouted, "No, no, not here." And immediately got shot in the throat. People will argue that how do you know that Anthony Nightingale was a spook? Well, his job was listed here as a loans officer for the Commonwealth Bank stationed at Noble Park. That doesn't prove anything. But then you get another Commonwealth employee who was at the site at the time. And these all people are supposedly on holidays. Lynn Beavers, she later on in about 2002 sued her employees, the Commonwealth Bank and Audiometrics of 814 Hawthorne Road, Burke Road, Hawthorne, sued them for injuries she sustained when she had to go inside the Broad Arrow Cafe to identify other Commonwealth Bank employees. And the only Commonwealth Bank employee that was inside the Broad Arrow Cafe and was dead was Anthony Nightingale. So that immediately tells you that, A, they were working at the time, and, B, they had to be spooks.
Well, let's leave it there for the moment and come back after the break. Former Victorian police officer Andrew Sutherland McGregor is my guest, talking about the Port Arthur massacre. We'll be right back, folks.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. What you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about
Welcome
the
back.
Bilderberg and New World Order. What you know about the real floor.
Right? Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about the New World Order. And my very special guest is Andrew Sutherland McGregor, former Victorian police officer, now retired. And he is an expert of note on the Port Arthur massacres. And as everybody knows, whenever a massacre happens, in come the leftist, communist, globalist, scumbaggery individuals, regardless of what party, whether that be the Labour Party in New Zealand or Australia or the Democratic Party in the United States, they are all UN-loving, globalist, gun-grabbing, communist, freedom-hating scum at the end of the day. They may deny it, but their policy says different. Now, interestingly enough, during the 1994 gun ban that the Clintons passed in the United States, you had some kind of information relevant to that regarding the Port Arthur massacre there, Andrew.
Well, the Labor Party in Australia brought out the same list. It was brought out by Rebecca Peters, an American who came out here in about 1984, studied at Sydney University, I think it was, studied law, gave it up, worked for the ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Commission, a very leftist body. And then she headed the Coalition for Gun Control in Australia. And after 96, she went back to America claiming to be an Australian. So if you ever hear of Dr. Rebecca Peters claiming she's an Australian, she's not. She was born in America. She came out here, got nationalised, and has gone back to America, continually pushing the George Soros agendas. And George Soros is the one who's been paying for all of her things. I think George Soros was also one of the major contributors to Obama's election campaign as well.
Okay. Now, you also told me over the break that Clinton was in Canberra around the addressing the Australian Parliament around the time of the Port Arthur massacre shootings, or did I hear that incorrectly?
No. When Martin Bryant was being sentenced, the sentencing hearing took place on the 19th, 20th and 22nd of November 1996. On the 21st of November 1996, President Bill Clinton was in Canberra, Australia, addressing both houses of the federal parliament. As one of my friends noted, when President Clinton first arrived in Australia and greeted Johnny Howard, he said, "Well done with your gun laws, mate." So, okay. The agenda with the gun laws, when you're looking at the Second Amendment in America, don't look just at America. Have a look globally. Have a look at Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, because they're all involved in the same thing to remove handguns from the general population. The agenda is not just for American. So when you get the Sandy Hook massacre and Bill Clinton's, you have a look at that, and you then associate it with the Dunblane massacre, which virtually went down with the exact same modus operandi.
Okay. Well, they don't seem to come up with any new game plans ever. It's always the same one over and over and over again. And strangely enough, everybody still keeps falling for these exact same parlor tricks. Have you noticed that?
Look, three very nice anti-gunners, it's Christopher Cantor from the Brisbane University, Professor Paul Mullen from the Monash University, and Philip Alpers, who is at the moment assisting. Who's your vice president? Who's the American? What's it? Liebman, what is his name?
Joe Biden.
Well, Philip Alpers at the moment is advising Joe Biden on the success of the so-called gun laws in Australia. He's talking rubbish, but they put out a lovely article called Mass Homicides, the Civil Homicides, was in a paper for the Psychiatry and the Law, printed only in America in about 2000, where they go through and list all the... there's, I think, seven different massacres at the time, and they state quite emphatically that the original massacre was created by Charles Joseph Whitman at the University of Texas, shooting in, was it August 1966? They said 1963, but that was the first lone nut gun massacre, according to them. Then you have a look at the second lone nut gun massacre, which was the McDonald's, the Huberty McDonald's massacre in 1984, and that was the first one that was used to bring in regulations for gun laws, and that followed the Brady coalition for I call them the Brady Bunch. It's quite easy. What was it? The Brady Coalition for Handgun Control, or something like that, which was created after Brady was wounded in the attempted assassination of President Reagan in 1981. So you have a look at that, and yes, every massacre, as far as they're concerned, follows the same modus operandi as the University of Texas massacre from 1966. And when you have a look at them, they do.
Okay. Continue, please. Because this is a big, complicated topic, and I feel in an inadequate position to actually inquire into things without knowing more specific information, which I'm sure that you do actually possess. So I actually kind of want you to take the reins and continue to elaborate on this as much as you can, because I'm actually quite absorbed in listening to you at the moment.
All right.
I apologize for putting you on the spotlight that as well.
After there was the Virginia Tech massacre, and I forget the name, the Korean student who supposedly went off his head and did all the shootings, I did an article, a 22-page article on that, and it went right through various not only the Low Nut gun massacres, but also some of the required American assassinations. And I used the article, as I said, Mass Homicide, the Civil Massacres by Cantor, Marlin and Alpers. And I also used another article. It was about the shooting of John Lennon, called The FBI Was the Shooter in the Rye. And you put those two articles together and you've got a quite clear picture of the gun agenda, as you know, or the anti-firearm agenda in America from 1994 with the Clinton administration. But it's not that difficult to follow once you see. If you put a person under a psychosis one way or another, and you've got total control of him, he will do what he requires. Now, in Australia, in the 1987 massacres, with Julian Knight stating that, you know, he believed he was shooting invading Martians, that tells you that the person is definitely not sane, and he's under a psychosis. When you have the second shooter at the Queen Street massacre, which was Frank Vilovic, again, when he's yelling out, "How do they expect me to kill people with this gun?" and some of the other statements, you also realise that he is not sane. He is under a psychosis. Now, Julian Knight and Martin Bryant were the only two in Australia to actually survive the mass shootings, but the... Also, James Knight, who did the abortion clinic shooting in 2002 in East Melbourne, he survived, and it took the Victoria Police 3 months to actually identify him. Nobody knew who he was. Now, in our modern society, how can you get a person, you know, that remains unidentified for 3 months? No fingerprints, nothing on him. And again, if you have a look at the going into shooting an abortion clinic, there's about the same time I think there was a shooting, an abortion shooting in America. Somebody shot a doctor, a couple of his patients as well. And all these things is purely the United Nations agenda. You know, you're people are permitted to have abortions if they want to. Well, that's their decision. If it's not against the law, but all you get the whole time is you are not permitted to attack this and that. It's a whole United Nations thinking control. It's a part of their agendas. So you have a look at In, was it 2005, 2006, the Clinton push on the ban of certain guns, the thing was coming to a close. President Bush was going to sign on it, but he never did. So you've got the gun control agenda up, and then you get the shootings at University at Montreal, one of the colleges at Montreal. There was another one, and then there's the Mines massacre where the Amish girls were massacred. Every time there is a gun agenda, there's massacres. There's low nut gun massacres. Now, that tells you it has to be a political agenda, nothing else, because people don't erupt spontaneously and go out and do things on a political line. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Right. So this year, when Hillary Clinton and the State Department are signing up the United Nations agenda room opposite the arms trade band, whatever it was, ADT, I think it was in July. So that's where you get the Aurora shootings. You've got the political agenda. And again, when Chief Dan Oates was being interviewed and somebody asked him about the door being opened at the theatre, he takes a great big swallow. Dan Oates from Colorado doesn't like telling lies. But he's forced to at this time because immediately behind him is FBI agent James F. Yacone. Well, I think that's how you pronounce his name. And you immediately see, you know, there's something wrong. You also have a look at the Aurora shooting. You've got a couple of witnesses stating, you know, that they saw somebody opening the door for the gunman after the person answered a mobile phone. He then went pop the fire exit door open, and they thought this is strange. It was even stranger when a bloke comes in and starts killing everybody with a AR-15 and a 100-round mag. But the day after that, you then get the professional witness, Christopher Ramos, came in on one of the things and was stating sort of thing, there was only the one shooter. Now, anyone who listened to Christopher Ramos sort of thing and knew what they were talking about, we were in the presence. Christopher Ramos is a professional witness. We've had them at the Port Arthur massacre. We've had them at the London bombing. We've had them at 9/11. These are people who immediately come out and give the right agenda. Or when something goes wrong, they need to negate proper evidence. They'll come out and give the required evidence. And when you have a look at the Sandy Hook massacre, again, you've got these professional witnesses, people who will come out and give the required line, and you listen to it later on, you say, you know, that's not correct with what I've already heard. You get professional witnesses, and they're rather easy to identify once you know what you're looking for.
Well, specifically, what are you looking for when you're looking for these witnesses?
Well, the first thing is, they know too much, and they apparently see too much. Now, if you're at a shooting, the first thing you do is you put your head down sort of thing, you start looking for an escape route. So with Christopher Ramos, where he sees the gunman spraying this, he sees the bloke next to him being shot, he's seeing too much. Christopher Ramos, and when most people speak and they need to stop or they get their thoughts back in order, they use the R pause. You know, I've got to tell you this, but Christopher Ramos, when he was doing his speaking, used the words just and like to fill in for the R, so he never stopped talking. He's been trained to speak without pausing, without giving the media head a chance to interrupt his line of presentation.
A professional, huh?
Say again?
With professionalism, in other words, trained to speak to the media. I've seen many, many, many people speak to the media, and as you say, the ums, the ahs, they become very apparent, particularly in sports people. But those who don't, on the other hand, who answer everything with crystal clear clarity and don't stop talking, they're usually the well-trained politicians and talking heads. We'll be right back with Andrew McGregor. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Final segment we have with Andrew McGregor, former Victorian police, retired, and he's talking about massacres, gun shooting massacres, and trained professional people coming on. Now, you were talking about some form of witness who came up while he was allegedly on holiday wearing a suit. Now, I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but when I'm on holiday, I barely wear any clothes at all, let alone a fracking suit.
The other thing that was very interesting was his wife was about 7 months pregnant. Now, how many people would actually travel on an aircraft when they're 7 months pregnant? Do aircraft permit people in such a condition to fly?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I thought you're not allowed to.
No, if she starts giving birth on the plane sort of thing, it's a major problem for the air crew and for the safety of the child. She's not supposed to. But Robin Atkins, with her husband, 7 months pregnant, he's on the tie. He's talking about the police present at Port Arthur, and there was none. He's talking about how good everything was, and it was rubbish, and he knew too much. And so once you put it all together and read it properly, there's only one conclusion you can come to, that he is a professional witness. He was down there on the spot. Another witness that was at the Port Arthur historic site was John Radler. Now, John Radler was the head guy of CNN in Australia, and he was down there at Hobart at the time. And he was preparing to give the news briefing of what happened at Port Arthur. And CNN had given him 3 days for the Port Arthur massacre. Now, what's so important about Australia to CNN that they'll give them 3 days interviewing, you know, this time on the CNN radio? Please tell me, or CNN News, why would CNN have 3 days available for John Radler in regard to the Port Arthur massacre? How about if you lost 70 American tourists killed down there? Then Bill Clinton and Hillary would have been bringing in their, you know, the 1994 hit list sort of thing, and attacking the Second Amendment by the State Department, because that forced Australia to bring in gun laws, and then those gun laws would be reciprocated in America. And that took place in 1996, and that was what the Port Arthur massacre was all about.
Okay. What resulting legislation was there that was implemented? Like, as a gun owner in Australia, what difference did it make to their daily lives before versus after the incident, after the shooting?
Well, there was apparently about 6 to 8 million firearms in Australia before the new gun laws were brought in. There was about 680,000 of them were handed in the gun buyback. And it was all done under the Health Act. You understand? It was paid through Medicare. What's Obama doing? Exactly the same modus operandi again as the Australians. I think there are over 1 million AK-47s vanished in Australia. They're all buried in somebody's backyards and things like that. They've been shipped in Australia prior to the laws and these new gun laws coming in, and the owners, for some unknown reason, Victoria had gun registrations. They were brought in by John Cain in 1984-85. And once you get, you know, and in Victoria, once the new gun laws came in, all the Victorian gun owners believed that if they didn't hand it in, the police would be knocking on their door. And so they had no choice. Other states that didn't have registration, a lot of firearms got buried. What else can I say? The new gun laws they brought in, magazines, I think it's a minimum of 3. Look, I'm not a shooter. I'm not a firearm owner. I know a couple of people who do. And as I said, you know, a firearm is only an implement. It's a tool. If you go out shooting foxes, sort of thing, sometimes you want a little bit more than 3 rounds up a clip. And if you're up north and you're hunting some of these wild pigs, you don't want only two shots, just to, you know. Yes, well, some of our picks.
Well, from my perspective, rifles and things of that nature, it matters not how many bullets are in the clip. I mean, it's just simply like, I mean, if I have a DVD printer, for example, that only prints one DVD, but I want one that has the ability to print 10, what is the government going to do? Saying, you don't need the ability to print 10 DVDs, we'll pass a law against it. No, it's just an implement. If I'm using it for crime, sure, investigate me, prosecute me, but don't restrict my access to technology that currently exists that would actually make legal and lawful activities easier. And regardless, the reason why they tell everybody you can't have these certain amount of bullets and clips, like in New Zealand, it's, I think, 10 maximum in a clip. And the reason why the Americans have the Second Amendment isn't in any way, shape or form to do with hunting. There's nothing in the Constitution about you need to have a certain amount of bullets or whatever to hunt ducks or things like that. It's simply that you need the population to be – sorry, you just need to be as well-armed in the population in terms of militia as the government or police would be, because you look at any other country through history where the police and the military are armed and the population is disarmed, it's called a police state.
No. You've got it wrong. Second Amendment states quite emphatically that every American will be the militia. There was, at the time, they weren't considering of having an army or a police force. It was the militia. And the militia represented the people. The people had the rights to defend themselves against tyrannical government. What do you have in America today? A tyrannical government. How do you know it's tyrannical? Simply because it's schizophrenic. A schizophrenic person is one who believes that everybody is out there to get me. Everybody, right? The American government believes that all Americans are potential terrorists. How dare they have it? It's pure schizophrenic.
Criminal psychosis, I think, is a disease not only of the mind, but a disease of institutions. And unfortunately, that's what we've got in the government these days, in almost all of our governments, I'd say.
Well, when you have a look, I think it was a police officer by the name of Jack Lamb was speaking about 15, 16 years ago, talking about what the FBI was doing and how the federal government was taking over all the little law enforcement agencies throughout Australia, the sheriffs, the state police, the county police, whatever. And they were training them, and I'll use the word here, indoctrination, because it is pure indoctrination, and they're frightened at the people. Now, in the Victoria police, we used to have people who used to talk about them versus us, the police, and you then start asking the question, how can a policeman protect and look after the community if it's them versus me? He can't do it. He needs to go on sick leave sort of thing and possibly find a new job. I look at a lot of people in government today, they need to find new jobs. But, all right, let's get on the one thing about the Port Arthur massacre. Martin Bryant was never trained. The gunman was. Martin Bryant, when the first two people were supposedly murdered, that's David and Sally Martin, was 58 kilometres away drinking coffee. Martin Bryant had never been properly trained in the use of firearms. The person at the Port Arthur Historic Site was. And when I started giving my lectures in 2001 and stating how the gunman deliberately targeted and shot Mrs. Nanette Mikak and her two young daughters, people jumped on me. How dare I be so nasty? But the actual fact is that the part of the agendas for the gun thing is to murder women and children at schools. And that was a Purdy in 1989 was one of the ones who first started over in America. So you have a look at the whole agenda. These low-nut gun massacres by by our governments, but that's America and Australia, have been, you know, are quite prepared to murder innocent women and children. They're not even going after the men. They don't want the men. They're going after, we'll say, the highest form of trauma possible. It's take out the women and children. You also get different disinformation agents coming along and, you know, blaming it on Israel or Mossad or things like that. That's totally, totally irrelevant. The people who are attacking you are your own government, be it Australian or be it American. It's not a foreign government that's attacking you. It's the own government. Joe Viles wrote down something and said that the Port Arthur massacre was a Mossad-run operation. The Mossad never controlled the federal organisation called the Protective Security Coordination Centre, which ran the massacre. So yeah, no matter what you believe, number one thing, if there's a gun massacre in a country, and that includes Norway, then that particular government has to run the massacre.
I think that's actually a nice cheery note to leave it on. Thank you, Andrew. McGregor.
You've had enough of me, Vince.
This is, we've run out of time, unfortunately.
Right,
yeah. Can anybody search you up on YouTube or on Google, Andrew McGregor, Port Arthur Massacre, to learn more, ladies and gentlemen. See you again sometime.